This is Colin Bedelin of Radio for Peace International. Today on Global Community Forum, we'll talk with Matthew Vestag, editor of the Progressive Magazine, a monthly publication distributed out of Madison, Wisconsin, and the United States. The Progressive is a voice advocating international peace and justice, opposing militarism, the concentration of power in corporate hands, and prejudice that promote human rights, a preserved environment, and a reinvigorated democracy. Matthew Vestag is joining us by phone today. Welcome to the show, Matthew.
My pleasure, Colin. Thanks for having me.
And Matthew, can you elaborate more about the goals or the mission of the Progressive as a news source?
Sure. The Progressive was founded in 1909 by Senator Robert La Follette of Wisconsin, who was one of the pioneers of the Progressive movement. And ever since then, the Progressive has stood for peace, nonviolence. We've been opposed to aggression and intervention by the United States abroad. We're for a fair and just economy and for safeguarding the environment as well. And as a news source, we distinguish ourselves in a couple of ways. One, by our investigative reporting, which we won several prizes. Another, by some of our commentaries. And our columnists include Myra Ivins and Howard Zinn and Barbara Ehrenreich and Adolf Reed and Gene Jordan. And so they give us a distinct voice. And so what we've been trying to do, especially since September 11th,
is to present a different voice to the American public than what they get through the mainstream. And here in the United States after September 11th, I've got to tell you, there were barely any voices of criticism allowed on mainstream media networks, or for that matter, even in the op-ed page of the New York Times. I've read the New York Times day in and day out since September 11th. I've looked in vain for one column by their paid columnists or one column by their freelancers that opposed the U.S. war in Afghanistan, that dared to say that the war was immoral or unjust or unnecessary. And I haven't been able to find a single one.
So I've seen a lot of articles that you've written on the website about the new McCarthyism. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, our website is www.progressive.org, and we try to do some things there that we don't always have space for in the magazine. And what the McCarthyism Watch feature there is all about, it's an offshoot of a cover story I did for the Progressive called The New McCarthyism. And what I did in that cover story was interview several people who have been approached by the FBI or the Secret Service for having so-called un-American things up on their walls, posters that are un-American, or an art museum in Texas that had a so-called un-American exhibit up. I mean, this is the essence of McCarthyism, to have the force of government come down upon you if you dare to express opinions contrary to the government's position. And so I interviewed several people like that, and then some journalists who were canned for writing articles that were unpopular, articles critical of George W. Bush. And I interviewed someone who had been fired from her job at, of all things, the U.S. Institute of Peace, because she was in favor of peace and against war after September 11th. I saw this as a new and very harrowing trend, and I still see it that way. And even as I was just proofreading the pages of that article right before it went to the printer, I heard of new examples of the new McCarthyism. For instance, there were people from Voices in the Wilderness, the great nonviolent protest group out of Chicago that has done so much to raise public awareness about the problems of sanctions against Iraq. This group, I talked to two individuals from it. They had gone to the post office in Chicago to buy stamps for their fundraising mailing. And the teller asked them what kind of stamps they wanted. Did they want an American flag stamp? And they said, no, we want any kind of stamp other than the American flag. The response from the teller, she called the police. I mean, this kind of hysteria that is beginning to sweep the country, I feel, is very reminiscent of the days of McCarthyism. It's not the deep and darkest day of McCarthyism, but it is an ominous cloud. And so I decided, well, I couldn't get all this stuff into my article. I might as well make room for it on the web, because the beauty of the web is there's such endless space there. So ever since that, in December and in January and February and now in March, I've been adding little items of people who have been victims of this new McCarthyism. For instance, last week I talked to a student who in Milwaukee, a private school, who had an assignment to put up any art exhibit he wanted as part of his final exam. And he put up an art exhibit of American flags upside down, and one of those, he wrote on it, Home of the Thieves, Land of the Slaves. And for that, he had that art exhibit torn down, and they just wouldn't let him put that stuff up there. And there have been other people who have been victims of this as well. There were two people in California, organic farmers, who when they were driving around town saw an overpass with American flags on it, and it's something that is just prevalent all over this country here. I see it all the time when I drive. And, you know, American flag is a freighted symbol sometimes. And these farmers and activists wanted to put up a sign that was less ambiguous, and they said, no more war or stop the bloodshed, something like that. I can't remember the exact words. And their sign was torn down. The American flags were kept up. And it is this kind of monotone, this is a monochrome that's allowed in the United States in times of war, I find very frightening to me. And so, you know, there's one example after another. I just talked to another editor who's been fired, another prize-winning editor who's been fired for criticizing Bush's Axis of Evil speech, among other things. And there's one example after another. And I thought for a while that maybe, well, I was making too much of this McCarthyism, perhaps. But no, the more I hear about it, the more stories I'm finding. And it may not go to the ultimate degree of the McCarthyism of the 1950s, but it's certainly the chilliest political time in my adult life. And I'm 43 years old.
So how do you suggest that people can still have a voice despite this new form of censorship?
Well, I certainly believe that people should go out in the street and use their First Amendment rights and exercise the right to protest and the right to assemble and the freedom of speech, because if we're so scared that the government's going to retaliate against us if we exercise our rights and thereby don't exercise our rights, we've already given up our rights. And that's certainly no way to go about it. People should do the most basic things, which are, you know, call your representatives, your senators, your congresspeople, and demand that they stand up to Attorney General Ashcroft, one of the scariest figures who's been in the Justice Department since the days of J. Edgar Hoover or Palmer, back in the Palmer raids of the 1920s. People definitely have to stand up to him and tell our legislators to stand up to him, because he has no regard whatsoever for most of those 10 Bill of Rights, with the possible exception of the second, the right to bear arms, which he fervently believes in. But the other ones, the protection for civil liberties, he doesn't really care about. And he's done a lot to erode and corrode those rights already. So people need to protest the assault on our liberties that's happening right now. Protest with their congresspeople and protest in the streets. I did talk to a guy, another victim of the new McCarthyism in Indiana, Evansville, Indiana, who last month was there to protest a visit by Vice President Dick Cheney. And this guy's an environmentalist, so he was across the street from where Cheney was speaking. In fact, this protester was standing on the public sidewalk outside the main city county building in Evansville, and he had a sign, Dick Cheney, 19th Century Energy Man. And he was the lone protester there, and the police arrested him for disturbing the peace. For what? For holding up a sign and exercising his First Amendment rights. Finally, the district attorney dropped the charges. But that's just outrageous that basic political speech is criminalized in the United States these days.
So in your editor's note in the November issue, you wrote that your doors have been locked ever since you received hate mail in response to a piece you wrote about the September 11th attacks. Are your doors still locked, and are you still receiving hate mail?
Well, I'm pleased to announce that our doors are now open. We had a staff meeting several weeks ago where we reviewed the policy and decided to open up our doors. But we did get a barrage of hate mail, really nasty hate mail, the kind of which and the volume of which we hadn't received really in my memory. And so the prudent thing to do, the staff decided, and I as the senior manager here decided, was to lock the doors. You know, one person had said, come to New York and we'll play progressive basketball with your head. Another one said, why don't you go to Afghanistan and stand next to your friend Osama bin Laden and catch the first missile we throw over there. I mean, it was that kind of idiotic schoolyard bully talk that you hear. But you never know in a frenzied moment who's going to be really threatening and not just blowing off steam. So, yeah, we did lock the doors. We've had a long-standing policy here at the Progressive of having open doors, and we do have open doors now. I'm glad we were. I was always reluctant to lock it, even when we're in the midst of getting most of that hate mail. And that hate mail has trickled off a great deal, though, you know, now it comes in maybe once a week, whereas before it was, you know, several a day.
You also wrote an article back in January called George Bush's Permanent War. Can you explain the content of this article?
Yeah, I think we need to understand that after September 11th, George Bush really had a reawakening or a rebirth. I mean, he's a born-again war maker. And he decided to ask for a vast authorization of force from Congress, and Congress gave him an authorization almost as vast as the one he asked for when they said that you could attack any individual, any group, or any nation that was involved, in your belief anyway, yours, George W. Bush's, in the attacks of September 11th. So basically, this allows Bush just to go virtually anywhere attacking any country if he can make even the most tenuous association with the events of September 11th. And what he's been doing is just that. I mean, look at he's sending troops to Georgia, the former Republic of the Soviet Union. He's sending troops to Yemen. He's sending troops to the Philippines. They're talking about directly aiding the rebel, the government forces of Colombia against the rebels there. I believe they've been doing that under the table, but they want to do that over the table now. And there's really no need. In Spain, they've been involving themselves in suppressing terrorists there. I mean, there's basically no spot on the globe where you could spin and put your finger on it where the Bush administration doesn't want to escalate this war on terrorism. And what are the limits of the war? There's no limits in time. The Bush administration has already said this is a war that's may last 5 years, may last 10 years, may last 50 years, may last 100 years. George W. Bush called it the first battle of the war of the 21st century. I mean, the guy is war crazy. And so there's no limit in time. There's no limit in places, I mentioned, because they'll go anywhere. There's no limit on weaponry. I mean, the Bush administration is not holding anything back. And at some point, these wars, perhaps even most scary of all, in Iraq, these wars may end with the United States using a nuclear weapon. I've already read speculation about this in the mainstream press, and this is the theory. The theory is that in 1991, the only reason Saddam Hussein did not use his biological or chemical weapons is that the Bush administration, that is George I, threatened him with nuclear annihilation if he did so. Now, Saddam Hussein, as brutal a person as he is not a suicidal person. And so he decided he'd rather stay in power and stay alive than use those weapons. Now, if the United States goes in and says the goal of attacking Iraq this time is killing Saddam Hussein and overthrowing him, Saddam Hussein is going to have no reason whatsoever from holding back anything. So if he has some trace biological or chemical weapons left, and who knows if he does or doesn't, if he has them, he is going to have no incentive not to hurl them at the United States. And if he hurls them at the United States, the U.S. is already on record, at least Bush's father was, that the United States is going to retaliate with a nuclear weapon. Is that what we want the war on terrorism to end with, a nuclear devastation by the United States, the first one since 1945 and the bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima? I sure don't, and I don't believe that most people in the world do. The American people is another question, because the American people have been given 10, 11 years of propaganda about Saddam Hussein, and I'm not here to buff Saddam Hussein's image, don't get me wrong, but the American people are so inured to the claim that Saddam Hussein is the next Adolf Hitler that I believe that the American people may go for just about anything or anything, including a nuclear weapon against him. But that doesn't mean those of us who oppose that shouldn't express ourselves, and those around the world shouldn't oppose this war in Iraq, that whether it ends in nuclear war or not, is inevitably going to end with the deaths of thousands upon thousands of more Iraqi civilians. And how many Iraqi civilians is the United States going to end up killing?
Again, you're listening to Global Community Forum on Radio for Peace International. We are talking with Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine based in Madison, Wisconsin, the United States. For more information about the Progressive, you can visit their website at www.progressive.org. So, Matthew, what do you think Bush's real motivations are for going to war in Afghanistan?
Well, there's several different kinds of motivations. I mean, at a personal level, the attack of September 11th solved the existential problem of George W. Bush's life. On September 10th, George W. Bush was the most immature 55-year-old in America. On September 11th, he had to grow up. On September 11th, he had to decide, you know, why he actually ran for president of the United States. He didn't even really know, I don't think, except to avenge the loss of his father's reelection campaign in 1992. So, in part, I think Bush wants to exaggerate the threat. Now, the threat was real, don't get me wrong. The threat on September 11th was real. The United States lost 3,000 people that day on just a completely grotesque, the most barbaric thing I've ever seen on TV, ever witnessed as a piece of history in my lifetime. But it is false, and it is inflammatory to say, as George W. Bush says, that freedom is at stake here. That the United, essentially to say that the United States survival is at stake. This whole comparison between Al Qaeda and Japan and Hitler in World War II is completely bogus. It's bogus. Why? Because Al Qaeda and Bin Laden have no capacity whatsoever to conquer Europe and conquer the United States. They can inflict horrific damage and kill thousands of civilians as they have. But freedom itself is not at stake here. They are not going to be able to conquer the United States. They will not be able to fly bombers over London for months and months at a time. They will not be able to bring their troops into the United States and take over the country. And that was a real risk in World War II, that if the Nazis had bombed and conquered England, if England fell, that at some point they were going to take over the United States. Now, there is no chance whatsoever that they're going to be able to beat back the Pentagon. I mean, these guys are terrorists. They will exact a toll of thousands of innocent lives, but the idea that they're going to take over the world is nonsense, and we should not let Bush get away with it. He likes to inflate the threat. Why? A couple reasons. It makes him feel better. It gives his reason for living even more importance, but also it placates some very powerful forces. It placates Pentagon contractors who are now getting a huge raise. They're making billions and billions of more dollars with this Pentagon budget that's soaring towards $400 billion a year, which is more than the militaries of the next biggest 15 countries combined. So it helps out the contractors and justifies the Pentagon budget. It also helps the Republican Party, because the Republican Party has always profited when they could make a credible claim that they are able to defend the United States better than the Democrats can. So if Bush, by waging this war and hyping this threat, is able to demonstrate that to the American public satisfaction, why, he may very well get reelected, and that's extremely important to him.
So what do you think about this other claim that the United States is in Afghanistan because they want to seize control of Central Asia because it's the second largest oil resource in the world?
Well, I'm not deaf to the claims of material interests in Afghanistan and Central Asia. I know that the oil in Afghanistan was a primary concern of the Clinton administration. In fact, the U.S. company that was wanting to run a pipeline through there basically was dictating U.S. policy throughout much of the Clinton administration. And so the corporations want, the Western corporations, U.S. oil companies want to get their hands on that oil, and Washington wants to help them get their hands on that oil. That's a part of it. I don't think it's the biggest part, though. I think it is more of an ideological issue. issue. It's more of a pragmatic political issue by the Bush administration trying to score points with the American public, and it's also some of those personal reasons that I alluded to. But it's not insignificant, and I don't want to make it out to be insignificant. The interesting thing on the whole oil equation that has happened since September 11th is the new primacy of Russia in the oil equation and the diminishing of the Saudi role. In fact, I've been surprised that the Saudi government has come under such fire from right-wing sources in the United States. The Wall Street Journal, the Weekly Standard, a lot of right-wing commentaries have said that, look, the United States has got a break with the Saudis, that the Saudis are a corrupt regime, which they are, of course. Women in Saudi Arabia don't fare much better than women in Afghanistan. And when Laura Bush was shedding tears over the treatment, and it was horrible treatment of women in Afghanistan, she didn't shed a tear for the horrible treatment of women in Saudi Arabia. But the whole oil equation is changing, and Russia is benefiting because Russia is going to be a more powerful oil broker. But I think under Putin, Russia wants to become close with the United States, and this is one way of doing a favor to the United States, in addition to the political support that the Russians gave the United States in the war in Afghanistan.
So, Matthew, I also wanted to read something that you wrote in the October issue, which was, "Our response here is to seek to illuminate the roots of terrorism in hopes that our government will stop watering them. The United States does not have clean hands in the world. The history of the last 50 years is a history of U.S. war and repression in one third world country after another." So have most of the articles responding to the September 11th attacks in The Progressive reflected the same response that you had in this editorial's note?
Yes, I think most of our writers share my view there that, first of all, the United States is in no position to draw a halo around its head and say, we are the apostles of good in the world. I mean, it takes an amnesiac, a person ignorant of world history, to make the claim that the United States in the last 50 years is acted as a force for good with a capital G. I mean, you can just take a trip around the globe. You can start at El Salvador and the 70,000 people that the United States helped kill during the death squads there in the 1980s in the Civil War, and the 30,000 people in the Contra War against Nicaragua, and the 200,000 people in Guatemala, and the 5, 10, 15,000 people in Chile, the overthrow of Allende, the thousands of people tortured in Brazil in the 60s under the generals supported by the United States. You can go to Angola in Africa, and Jonas Savimbi, who was aided by the CIA, who just died, you know, our freedom fighter, some freedom fighter. And, you know, you can go and you can go to the Congo, you can go to the Philippines, you can go to Indonesia in 1965, where the United States approved the overthrow of Sukarno that led to the deaths of 500,000 to a million people. You can go in 1975 to East Timor, where with a wink and a nod, Henry Kissinger and Gerald Ford told Suharto he could invade, and so he invades and 200,000 people die. You know, and there's Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia, where the U.S. war in the 60s and early 70s cost 2 to 3 million people. And, you know, the United States is just not in a position to say that we're the good guys. And it's not really in a position to say so today. It's been the biggest donor to Israel, has supported Israel's human rights abuses in the occupied territories, the biggest donor to Colombia, which has been involved in this brutal four-decade civil war, which isn't getting any better. It's getting worse. And the FARC has a lot to blame for itself, too, in this whole deal. And Turkey, another huge recipient of U.S. aid, has a terrible human rights record of torture and genocidal kind of activity toward the Kurds. So look at the United States record in full, and it's not something you can take pride in. So that's one response that we've had after September 11th. And another one, though, I think we need to be clear. Not all the roots of September 11th can be tied up in a knot and placed at the doorstep of Washington. Some of these roots have other causes, and those are fundamentalism itself is a force for very dangerous things in the world. Anti-Semitism is, as I put it in that article, one of the longest polluted rivers in the world, and it too, is a force for very violent and ugly things, which we saw most recently in the decapitation of Daniel Pearl, Wall Street Journal reporter who was assassinated by his captors in Pakistan. Just one of the most disgusting things I've seen since September 11th. So that's a force, too. The United States is responsible for some. The United States is responsible for funding the rebels, the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, who finally took over with the Taliban. I mean, the United States was helping Osama bin Laden. We need to recall that. And so those are some of the points we made, but also the point that violence rarely solves a problem, that war rarely solves a problem, and that even when the cause is just, as Howard Zinn pointed out in a very important article, even when the cause is just, as it was on September 11, the United States had been attacked. Under international law, it is legal for a country to respond after it's been attacked. So even when the cause is just, the war may not itself be just. Why? Because in the execution of that war, governments, and the U.S. government was doing this, governments will kill innocent people. How many innocent people? Hundreds, certainly. Maybe as many as 4,000, I've seen by one credible account. And these people had nothing to do with the Taliban, nothing to do with al-Qaeda or Osama bin Laden. And on the scales of justice, does it balance when 4,000 innocent people in Afghanistan lose their lives and a comparable number in the United States lose their lives? I don't want to be in that kind of balancing act, and I don't think it's justified on a moral basis. So those are some of the voices and some of the reasons you hear in the progressive that you really don't hear almost anywhere else. You certainly haven't heard them in the New York Times or in the Washington Post or in the Wall Street Journal or on ABC, CBS, NBC, PBS, Fox News, certainly not. I mean, the one place that I think has done a very good job of covering this question, other than the progressive, and I'm biased on that, obviously, is Z Magazine. I look to Z Magazine and ZNet or ZMag.org for a lot of help, intellectual help, and argumentation help during this period to give me the facts and the counter-arguments that were needed, and we tried to do some of that work here, too.
That leads me to my last question, which is, how does the progressive respond to the mainstream press? Does it try to counter it? Does it try to provide alternatives to it, or simply just be an independent voice?
Well, we try to do all the above. We try to point out the fallacies in the mainstream media, the holes in their stories, the biases in their stories. We also try to present our own arguments about what's going on in the world. We also try to report on our own facts. We were some of the first publications in the country to report on Attorney General Ashcroft's wiping out the right to counsel that prisoners have. You know, prisoners now will get their conversations with their lawyers eavesdropped upon by the government, which is an outrageous violation of the Fourth Amendment. So we do some original reporting. We do original thinking. We try to present coherent arguments from perspectives and voices that are precluded from the channels in the mainstream media. And so that people, you know, even if they don't agree with us, you know, a lot of our readers are not self-described progressives or liberals or leftists or, you know, whatever you want to call us. But they are curious about what the other side thinks or what another side thinks, and they also have some interest in the fate of the world. And they recognize that we have a perspective here that they're not getting elsewhere, and they want to hear an articulate point of view. Certainly, if I were a citizen of the United States and I was only hearing one side of a story, I'd want to hear the other side. And we give that other side.
So are there any last words that you want to tell our listeners about the progressive?
Yeah, I would just urge people to go up to our website, which is probably the easiest place to get hold of us, to sample what we're doing in the magazine and exclusively on the web. And it's real easy to remember. It's www.progressive.org. And we welcome as many visitors as possible, and we hope you enjoy the site, and we hope you enjoy the magazine.
Well, this concludes today's edition of Global Community Forum on Radio for Peace International. I'm Pauline Bartolone.